It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, the artist.
When I was a kid, being legally blind and having to wear these glasses that look like pop bottles, I think I felt like a mutant.
The misfit artist, the lone creative genius. They're familiar stereotypes, occasionally even accurate. Mark Mothersbaugh co-founded the legendary new wave band Devo, but his first love was visual art. Maybe because when he was a kid, he couldn't see. His first solo museum show just opened, and today we'll talk with him about art and the creative impulse. And if you've ever wished you could make art, or wished you made better art, one path might be to forget about being original and just steal, like an artist.
You're literally a mashup of what you let into your life.
Austin Kleon makes a living as a writer and artist. He calls himself a writer who draws, but he is not very hung up on originality. He's the author of a widely quoted manifesto on creativity in the digital age called Steal Like an Artist.
The title is a playoff of something that's actually misattributed to Picasso: good artists copy, great artists steal. As far as I can tell, Picasso actually never said that. It was actually T.S. Eliot. He was talking about poets. I was shocked myself to find out how many artists really use that term, stealing. And it's not just artists, it's people of all fields. Someone like Steve Jobs or Kobe Bryant, he talks about stealing basketball moves when he was watching tapes when he was young. Someone like Francis Ford Coppola will say, you steal when you're younger, and then you add something new to the pot, and then pretty soon people are stealing from you.
It's so interesting, though, because you're talking about people who we think of as some of the great creative geniuses. And we have that idea that what's really valuable in art or business or entertainment or, you know, whatever your form of art is, what's really valuable is originality.
Yeah, and in human history, the whole concept of originality is kind of an invention of the 19th century. We really don't have this idea of a lone creative genius until the Romanticists really come along. Before someone had a genius or they had geniuses that kind of like guided their lives. But then when Romanticism comes around, we have this idea that there's like this person that's kind of ordained by the gods with this unique creative ability. I guess my big quest with the book is to just kind of upend that a little bit and to say, actually, nothing comes from nowhere, and that all these creative geniuses that we think of, they were all thieves, and they all borrowed liberally, and they took things and they reworked them, and their genius, if you can call it that, is actually the way that they take their influences and gave us something new.
So you take this concept of stealing like an artist. If art is theft, then there should be a skill to it, and you sort of turn it into almost a lifestyle. So can you kind of start going through some? I mean, if you're a young artist starting out and somebody says to you, no, don't worry about being original, just go out and steal, what do you do?
Well, it's almost like a conceptual thing. It's almost like a way of thinking about what you do. My big thing that I tell young artists is that you are a mashup of what you let into your life. And that actually comes from something my mother used to say to me, which used to drive me insane. She used to say, garbage in and garbage out. That drove me so crazy when I was young, but now I realize that she was dead on. There's a DJ named DJ Spooky, and he says, as a DJ, you're only going to be as good as your record collection. So what that means is, as an artist or a young artist, you're only going to be as good as the stuff you're surrounding yourself with. And that includes not only the books you read, the art you look at, your teachers, but it also includes your environment, where you choose to live, your friends. It's everything. You're literally a mashup of what you let into your life.
Okay, well, so as a young person, let's say you say, great, then I'm going to make sure that all the music I listen to is really great music and that I only read the best literature. Then what? I'm going to wake up one morning and make great art?
I think what happens is after you start gathering your influences, then you start copying. And we're not talking about plagiarism here. We're talking about learning the moves. Like if you're Kobe Bryant, you watch the tapes, you know, you see Jordan's moves, and then you try them out on the basketball court. Now, what happens is as you try to copy these heroes, you start realizing that you're not quite built like them. I'm using the basketball metaphor because I think it's easier. You start realizing that your body's different, that you have to start adapting, that you're incapable of perfectly copying these heroes, that you have to make adjustments to suit your own personality. The stuff that you have through your life influences and things like that starts seeping in. And then after you start copying your heroes, you start combining them together to get interesting combinations. And then finally, I always think of it as like you take something from one hero and you take something from the other, and pretty soon you have this kind of Frankenstein monster of your work. And then part of your job is to start transforming that monster into something smooth, something that kind of stands on its own.
At what point did you begin doing the newspaper blackout poems?
The newspaper blackout started right after I got out of college. You know, I studied creative writing in college. I actually did go to, like, creative writing workshops. And the thing about creative writing workshops and about college in general is college is this perfect environment for a young writer because you have a captive audience. You've got people paying to read your writing, your fellow students, and then you've got a professor who's getting paid to read your writing and pay attention to it. So you have like what every artist or writer dreams of, this captive audience. And then when you get out, you realize that no one cares, you know, that you like have to start from ground zero and you have to build a readership and you have to do something that people aren't artificially paying attention to you. And so when I got out of college, I had no outlet anymore. And I froze up. And I submitted a few short stories to journals and got rejections just like every young writer. And I suddenly realized that I was writing short stories. I mean, I like short stories, but that wasn't really what I wanted to do. I wrote short stories because that's what they teach you to write in college. So I started a blog. And one of the things about having a blog is you have to fill it with something. And one day I was staring at my Microsoft Word screen and that cursor was just blinking at me like it was taunting me, you know, and I was trying to like pull something original out of my soul, and I looked in the recycle bin with all these newspapers stacked up in it, and I thought, man, I don't have any words, but right there next to me are millions of them. So I picked up one of my drawing markers and I just started circling words and then blacking out the rest, and I thought I was ripping off the government. I thought I was doing like redacted CIA haikus. But it turns out that there was actually this long history of people finding poetry in the newspaper. After I started posting them to my blog, people started telling me that there was this long history. But instead of getting discouraged that my idea wasn't completely original, I built my own family tree. I researched the form. I went back as far as I could go. And I stole everything I could from the people who came before, and I tried to make my poems better. And in a couple of years, I put out my first book, Newspaper Blackout.
Do you remember one? Can you recite any?
Yeah, probably one of my favorites, or a kind of a fan favorite, is called Overheard on the Titanic. And it was actually a music review. And it's very short, but it goes, I mean, yes, we're sinking, but the music is exceptional.
Austin, when you give these talks to young people now, what do you say at the end?
The thing I say at the end is YMMV, your mileage may vary. I say, there are no rules. Have fun. Make up your own rules. Take what you can from me, steal what you can, and make your own thing.
Austin Kleon is the author of Steal Like an Artist, and more recently, Show Your Work, a guide to sharing creativity and getting discovered. And speaking of sharing, you know that idea that creative genius is all about single-minded obsession? One person's unique calling or vision? Well, that's just one model of creativity. Another is the collaborative duo. Think Lennon and McCartney, Watson and Crick. Joshua Wolf Schenk calls these powers of two, and he says it's time we recognize the explosive creative potential of partners. Steve Paulson wanted some details.
Joshua, you talk about creative pairs as forming what you call a single organism. Can you explain what you mean by that?
When two people meet, they might be excited by each other. There might be a kind of feeling of jolt. Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King or Sergei Brin and Larry Page, and yet you still have two distinct individuals. Over time, when people begin to work together and they become associated with a common body of work, or they become wrapped up in each other, a we emerges. And that is an enormously interesting phenomenon because, of course, the individuals remain and there is a sense of distinct ego, but that also begins to break down as you become part of this larger thing. And the science of relationships has shown us that at a very basic cognitive level, we begin to lose the distinctions between ourselves and other people, so that the we is not just a figure of speech and a way of talking. It also becomes a part of the way we think. There is even a phenomenon of a shared mind.
Well, it's interesting that you used the example of Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King, because Dr. King, of course, is seen as the great leader of the civil rights movement. He's not generally paired with Ralph Abernathy. I mean, of course, historians of the civil rights movement know of him, but they would see him as a secondary figure.
That's right. And it's very common that one person in these partnerships is out front and one person may be the decided leader. That was certainly the case with Martin Luther King. They were a partnership and they were not entirely equal. And Martin Luther King was also the spokesman and the philosopher king of that movement. It's very appropriate to understand his distinct role and what he did that was different from Abernathy, but it's very hard to understand what they created without looking at the they, without looking at the two of them together. And that happens over and over again. When you begin to understand relationships, you have to rewrite the Western canon.
So play that out for me a little bit. I mean, how did the coming together of Abernathy and King create some kind of new dynamism?
Martin Luther King was an abstract man. He was an intellectual man. He thought in these big ways. He had a soaring intellect. Abernathy was much more of a tactician. He had a very earthy sense of humor. He was the one who could really get the crowd riled up and could really connect with them in a really basic way. And he would set the stage for King to come and, you know, give this overview and speak not just to that particular audience. He was really speaking to the nation and to the world about the philosophy of nonviolence, which, you know, is not necessarily the thing that is going to get the crowded black church sort of roused up and ready for the particular action of that day. But it's also true that a lot of what happened between King and Abernathy is hard to trace. They were on the road together. They shared hotel rooms and motel rooms together. In fact, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, he was in a suite at the Lorraine Motel that they called the King Abernathy Suite because they shared it so often together. And we don't know precisely what they said. And after King was gone, Abernathy was the only firsthand witness, of course, and people don't necessarily trust everything he said. Maybe his ego was involved. So it's hard to get at a lot of these relationships because so much is unrecorded.
Now, you write about a lot of creative pairs, and one of the most interesting ones was the partnership between C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Of course, went on to write famous books in their own rights, but how would you describe their creative partnership?
It was a partnership between two distinct men who each authored his own independent body of work, and yet, in a way, they co-created this form of the mythic parable soaked in Christian imagery, and they did it through relentless conversation. They met each other. They were academics in a kind of stuffy environment. A lot of their colleagues would have thought them entirely foolish for thinking about the stories that they thought about made-up languages and talking lions and all that sort of thing. And yet they got each other, they loved the work that each man was doing, and they gave each other permission and were an audience and were an ever-present critic and responder and resonator for what the other did. You could really say in the big picture that they co-created each other as authors, even though they are not co-authors in the ordinary sense.
Well, you give the example, going back to particularly this creative partnership between C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, of the critique that Lewis made of Tolkien's poem, The Lay of Lethian. Am I saying that right?
I believe so.
What did Lewis say about this poem?
One detail that's critical is that Tolkien had this poem on his desk for 4 years. He had not shared it with anyone until he shared it with Lewis, which is itself really significant, that he was emboldened and had the the courage to share it with Lewis because of the shared sense. And Lewis immediately wrote back praising it and saying that he would give him more detailed criticism. And then when he gave him the criticism, he did it in this very clever and playful way. He created a fictional panel of scholars, and he named them Pumpernickel, Peabody, Schick, Bentley, and Schuffer. He wrote the responses in these voices as though a formal presentation had been made to an academic panel, and, you know, five men were sitting in their wooden chairs in front of a oak-paneled room, intoning their distinct reactions to this work. And that allowed him to go into a great deal of detail and give this very idiosyncratic character to the critique. And the funny thing is that it was a critique to a piece of creative writing, but it was itself its own piece of creative writing.
Now, that's fascinating. Now, one of the most interesting stories you write about is about the poet Emily Dickinson. And she would seem to be the poster child of the lone genius, you know, off in her room creating these incredible poems. But you say that's a mistake to see her that way.
This is an important story for me because I'm a writer and I need an enormous amount of solitude. And my creative relationship with my book editor is very much in the rhythm of solitude and connection alternating with each other in a variety of ways. And I was dumbfounded to learn about Emily Dickinson and to see my idea of her, an idea that many people shared, that she was tremendously isolated and disconnected from the world around her in order to make these beautiful poems alone in her room, is really not the full picture. It is true that she withdrew from the world around her, that she didn't leave her father's home, that she didn't obey these social niceties, but she was doing that not to be disengaged, but because she needed a lot of space in her mind and around her in order to think and to gestate these letters and these poems, which she sent out like missives to the world. And she not only did that to connect with people in an abstract way, she was continually reaching out and choosing people to be her correspondents, to be her mentors, to be her editors in a way, and sending hundreds of poems to these people and thousands of letters. And if you look at the material of her work, it's electric with emotion and interpersonal passion. And this was something that she was deeply consumed by. So it's a story of her, and we need to revise our understanding of Dickinson, but it's also a broader story of people who need solitude, not because they're disinterested in the human world around them, but because from a place of solitude, they can connect better. And from a place of solitude, they can do the things that they do best. Steve Wozniak is another example in a totally different field in a different era, but he needed a lot of space around him to tinker with his gadgets and to work out these engineering problems. But it really became magic when he was able to bring that to someone like Steve Jobs, who knew how to shape it and knew how to market it and knew how to send him back into his cave with a particular assignment. And that movement is really critical to understand and really personal to me because it's so much part of my life as a writer.
Yeah. Well, to go back to the example of Emily Dickinson, I can imagine this might have worked in two ways. So if she's writing a poem and she sends it to someone else, that other person might write back with comments about it, maybe even criticisms, or the other person might just be kind of the audience that she needs. In other words, she sort of has that person in mind as she's writing the poem.
I think that's a very incisive observation. And sometimes what we need from someone is a certain kind of presence, is a certain kind of receptive attitude, and that stirs us up and brings something out of us, and we're not necessarily looking for any particular response. I know that's the case in my life, too, that I write differently, I speak differently, I feel like I am a different person in relationship to other people. And sometimes it's not any kind of discrete thing they say or do. It's the feeling that it generates in me. And that's something really at the bottom of this whole inquiry for me. I'm just fascinated by that feeling of chemistry and all the places it can lead. What's fascinating, though, is that when you really begin to appreciate how much of creativity is dialogical, how much of it is shaped in literal or metaphorical conversation between people, and you then take that model and look at how the creative mind works when we're walking on a beach or we're in front of a computer writing by ourselves, what happens in our mind is also a dialogical phenomenon. When you listen to creative people from Paul Simon to the great poet Ruth Stone, when you listen to creative people describe these aha moments, these moments of insight in Genesis, it's an experience of two forces, two places in their mind, or sometimes it seems like it's something from outside of your mind that's sort of transmitting to you. It's very hard to describe, and that's the reason why this old idea, this old myth of the muse is actually helpful, whether you believe in it as a true phenomenon or not. It's useful as a model for how the creative mind works.
Joshua Wolf-Schenck is the author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Steve Paulson talked with him. Coming up, the co-founder of the new wave band Devo just opened his first solo art exhibition. We'll catch up to talk music, art, and the creative life. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Remember Devo, the new wave band with the matching outfits and the flower pot hats? They looked kind of like robots. They were big in the 80s, but the band's founders actually met earlier as students at Kent State University. They were there on May 4th in 1970 when the National Guard opened fire and killed four students during an anti-war protest. Those were dark times, and they helped form the philosophy behind Devo, the idea that humanity is regressing or de-evolving. One of the founders of Devo is Mark Mothersbaugh, and he still makes music. He's scored a bunch of Wes Anderson's films. But these days, he is also getting attention for his visual art. His work is the subject of a new solo museum show that's touring the country. And when Doug Gordon talked with Mark Mothersbaugh, he discovered that if it weren't for his nearsightedness or myopia, he might never have become an artist.
Mark, you have this new major exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver called Myopia. Why did you decide to call it Myopia?
I was almost 8 years old. I'd been getting in trouble in first and second grade as being a problem child, and they didn't know what was wrong with me. They thought I was crazy or something, I think. I was getting disciplined all the time. And then near the end of second grade, I got diagnosed as legally blind. Nobody had realized that I couldn't see past 6 inches. So I got my first pair of glasses, and I saw clouds, and I saw things flying in the sky, birds, and I saw smoke coming out of chimneys. All for the first time, I saw the school I went to. I saw what a house looked like. I saw the whole housing development I lived in, kind of, because we were at a hill. It was amazing. It was such an intoxicating event that I just started drawing the things I'd seen. And one of the things that really impressed me was trees, partly because I'd never seen a tree past the trunk, the part that you run into when you're playing in my front yard when I was a kid. I saw what they look like at the top of a tree, and I just thought that was an amazing thing. So I was drawing trees, and this teacher that had spent the year disciplining me and being totally frustrated with me said the first nice thing a teacher ever said to me. She said, "You draw trees better than me." So I went home that night, and I dreamt I was going to be an artist.
Yeah. Let's talk about your postcard diaries. Can you tell me a bit about them?
Back in the early 70s, you know, it started because of my vision being really hard to use perspective on big pieces of art. I would do my drawings small first, and then if I saw something I really liked, I could enlarge it. And so I was doing all of these postcard-sized drawings, and then somewhere in the early, mid-70s, I realized they were actually kind of my diary. I was kind of creating a diary. So I started saving them. I would save them in a stack. And when I got 100 drawings, I would put them in a binder and then put it on the shelf. So now it's 35 years later or more. And there's like about 350 of these books now.
And 30,000 postcards?
It's more than 30,000 at this point.
Do you have a favorite one that you can describe?
A favorite one?
Yeah, or one.
Out of 35,000 drawings?
Yeah, I asked the tough questions, Mark.
Yes. I did a sculpture in the last 3 or 4 years. It was a giant ruby. Someone let me carve it into custard.
Mm-hmm.
The first drawing I did of it, with these custardy kind of poo piles, you know, kind of looking like custard out of a custard machine, had eyeballs.
Do you ever go back and look at the older ones to try and get a better understanding of yourself, since they kind of serve this autobiographical diary purpose?
Well, this museum show has kind of forced that on me. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of drawings I never looked at since the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. Then I had to go back and look at these things again. It was kind of interesting how your paranoias and your nightmares and your dreams and your expectations and your optimistic moments and your lyrics and your drawing style change as you get older. So it was kind of interesting to get to do that again, because a lot of it I looked at and I said, man, I was really a jerk. And then some of it I look at and I really love it. When I did most of this, I'd never intended for there to be an audience. I didn't censor myself. I let it be very kind of wherever the drawings wanted to go. And some of it was very stream of consciousness and kind of crazy when I look back at it. And I realized how things like having kids make you want to be a better person. And it changed my art, too. It made my art look different.
Yeah. Let's talk about Beautiful Mutants. This is your series of mirror image photographs. Tell me about them.
I've had a long time fascination with symmetry, and especially with human form, because humans, although we have two eyes, two ears, a nose in the middle, a mouth in the middle, two arms, two legs, two feet, we're not really as symmetrical as a lot of things in nature. Insects are usually far more precisely symmetrical than us. And if you slice a human down the middle and copy the one half and flip it over, the interesting thing I found out, especially in portraits, is that humans tend to have one half of their face. If you flip it and make it one face that way, there tends to be a side of every human that's a little more innocent and maybe sometimes angelic and oftentimes pretty or more aesthetically beautiful. And then there's a side that's darker. There's a side that looks like your dark side, your malevolent side. And they're both there, attached together all the time in your life, in real life. But you never see them as separated unless you purposely split them and flip them over to make these totally symmetrical faces, which become disturbing. Even the pretty ones are disturbing.
Does it vary? Do you use the beautiful side or the malevolent side, or does it depend on the individual picture?
I use them both usually, and I tend to mix them up a little bit. If I have a gallery show, you have to look around to find the matches.
They're very beautiful and eerie, and many of them strike me as kind of a cross between the work of Deanne Arbus and David Lynch, and maybe even in some of them a kind of a hint of H.P. Lovecraft. And they reflect your interest in symmetry and mutation. What is it about symmetry and mutation that you find so intriguing?
I think when I was a kid, being legally blind and having to wear these glasses that look like pop bottles, I think I felt like a mutant. But like also, I think I came to the conclusion early on that I was going to embrace my mutation. I was going to embrace my weakness, and I was going to let it make me be a stronger person, be a stronger artist.
Yeah, and that makes me think of what the curator of your myopia exhibition, Adam Lerner, says. He says that you believe mutations define the essence of originality.
Early on, Devo, we were asked if we had a motto. Our motto from the beginning was, choose your mutations carefully.
Exactly, yeah. Have you ever tried to apply the symmetrical mirror effect that you use in the Beautiful Mutant series? Have you ever tried to apply it to your music?
Yes. I wrote music for a film called Royal Tannenbaums. I wrote this kind of nice, cute little bouncy piece of music. When we did the next film, the same director, Wes Anderson, was Life Aquatic. And there's a scene where Bill Murray, he's like this loser version of Jacques Cousteau. They haven't made any good movies. They haven't had any good finds. He's really proud of his boat. And there's one moment in the film where Bill Murray goes, let me tell you about my boat. And then it cuts to a giant elaborate cutaway that Wes built at the Cinecittà stages in Rome. And Wes said, can you make me a piece of music for this scene that's kind of like the scene with Angelica and Gene Hackman was like in Tannenbaum's? And I said, sure. So I wrote a couple sketches for him and I played them for him. And he goes, no, those don't really do it. And so I wasn't sure what to do, and I was busy every day. I would be at work at Mutato, but in my head I'd be thinking about this box of old photographs I had and how I was going to mutate them that night. I held up a piece of music that was the music that Wes liked from Royal Tenenbaums to a mirror and played it in reverse. And so I came back the next day and recorded it that way. And he came into the studio and he listened to the piece of music from Royal Tenenbaums. It was called Scrapping and Yelling. I played it backwards and changed the instruments up a little bit to match a different feel for a different movie. But he went, that's it. That's perfect. So it was kind of interesting. I waited until we finished recording it before I told him that you already own that music, facing the other direction.
That's a great story. I got to ask you about these very elaborate and beautiful, almost kind of Rube Goldberg-esque sculptures, which you call orchestrions. And the first one I think you made was based on bird calls, and it's called Mechanical Aviary.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I collect a lot of musical instruments, and I collect a lot of musical sound makers. At one point, I was collecting bird calls, and I had, I don't know, like 150 bird calls. Some of them were over 100 years old, and they were definitely from around the world. And I was doing some pieces of sound conceptual music for Wes Anderson's movie Moonrise Kingdom. And he sent me a piece of footage where there was two kids running through the woods and there was no sound on the film he sent me. And it seemed so eerie and odd to be watching these two kids in this big woods, you know, with leaves and trees, and they're running through it and there's not a single sound. And so I just started playing around with some of the bird calls while I was watching it. Then I became distracted and forgot about the movie, and I started playing with making rhythms out of the bird calls, and I started coming up with stuff that I really loved. I thought, wow, this is really hitting on something. But you couldn't sit there with a box of 40 or 50 bird calls in your lap and play anything with any kind of precision, or you couldn't get them in real time. You couldn't have three or four things overlapping. So I had come across this kind of crazy, interesting guy. He built orchestrions for amusement parks. He thought what I was doing was kind of crazy, but he was perfectly suited for building mechanisms that could crank cranks for turkey calls. It could tap little leather sacks gently for little peeping noises. And he helped me come up with all these different little miniature machines. And so we put together a machine with about 60 of those, the best of the bird calls. I'm able to control it with a keyboard, and I can write memory onto a memory chip and play music that I write for this thing. I call it a bird call aviary.
Adam Lerner, the curator of your Myopia exhibition, has said, Mark Mothersbaugh himself is the work of art. Art is not about what you make, it's about how you live. So this raises the question, how have you managed to live such an artful life?
I don't know. You know, Naka, I don't know. I am who I am, and I've always been that, and I've been true to it. And I can say that some of it is really, you know, it's hard, but some of it, I was lucky too, you know? I was really lucky. I was part of an art group. Something about what we did, the music that we did, attracted the attention of people like David Bowie and Brian Eno and William Burroughs and Timothy Leary. And I just met all these interesting people through my art, and I never thought about going somewhere else.
It's lucky for us. And you have that great line I know about Devo is kind of the thinking man's Kiss. I love that line, and it raises the question, does that mean that Kiss is the stupid man's Devo?
I'll let you say that.
Okay, which I just did. And we'll see if it makes the final cut. It's a beautiful world for you. For you. For you.
Mark Mothersbaugh's visual art is on display in an exhibition called Myopia. It opens at the Contemporary Art Museum for Austin on February 13th. Mothersbaugh talked with Doug Gordon. And you can see examples of his art in a slideshow on our website, ttbook.org. And coming up, what to read to celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Charles Duhigg. I'm the author of The Power of Habit, which is a book about the neurology and psychology of habit formation. The book I'd like to recommend to anyone listening is The Children by David Halberstam. The Children is this kind of magnificent book that traces the efforts of the young participants in the civil rights movements of the 1960s, individuals like John Lewis. The young participants, the young activists of the civil rights movement, were a group that were very distinct from Dr. Martin Luther King and his group. In many ways, they formed themselves in opposition to their older peers. Dr. King was actually only in his late 20s, early 30s when the civil rights movement was going on, but the children, John Lewis and his peers, they were in their teens. And they were, in many ways, the force that actually powered much of the integration, much of what we think of today as the bravest acts of the civil rights movement. And the reason why I love the book, The Children, is that it's incredibly inspiring, not only in its explanation of how powerful individual agency, individual acts of courage can be, but also in reminding us that when movements happen, they're incredibly complicated. It's not an easy or nice story of good guys and bad guys and the good guys win. Instead, it's a story of groups that come together, oftentimes who are fighting each other as much as they're fighting their common enemy. And that it's from this tension, this anger, this disputes over strategies, that's where the power of movements, the power of social change, most often comes from. And it's messy, and it's unglamorous, and it's sometimes not pretty to look at. But it is the single most important thing that can end up changing the world. And in the case of the United States and race relations, clearly changed everything that's happened since then. One of the reasons I love The Children is it gives us this completely new perspective on the civil rights movement. It's one that's hinted at in the new movie Selma, that the civil rights movement is much more complicated, much more tension-filled than we've been led to believe. And one of the things I love about The Children is that it goes into those tensions. It explains those tensions. It shows that there were people within the civil rights movement who saw Martin Luther King as a false hero, as the enemy of the movement. And Martin Luther King, for his part, saw many of these students who were on the front lines, who were incredibly brave, as foolish and naive and potentially destructive to the cause. Every single thing that's interesting about history is usually complicated. And when it comes to civil rights history, one of the most important things of the last century, it's even more complicated than most. And that complication tends to get lost. But books like The Children by David Halberstam, they explain it in this wonderful, glorious detail that makes it seem real and alive.
Charles Duhigg recommends The Children by David Halberstam. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Duhigg on our website at ttbook.org. With the movie Selma out and Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday this week, we've been thinking about the origins of the civil rights movement. It seems like a good time to revisit Steve's conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns. It's the story of America's great migration, the epic struggle for freedom that saw 6 million people migrate north from the southern states before the civil rights era, and equal opportunity.
It was such an oppressive, authoritarian, and totalitarian world that's almost hard for us to conceive of. In many courtrooms in the South, there was actually a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. That is how extreme the notion of mixing was taken to a level that's almost incomprehensible.
There were, of course, far more odious forms of these laws. I mean, for instance, a black person had to wait to be spoken to before...
They had to wait to be spoken to.
Yeah, and then...
They could not reach out to shake the hand of a white person. How many wonderful and amazing interactions and friendships might have occurred between these people, but they were not permitted to experience them because there was fear on all sides of ever breaking this code, because whites could be ostracized for breaking the code, and blacks could face assault and, in fact, death.
To put it bluntly, if a black man looked at a white woman the wrong way or spoke to her, I mean, that could get him killed.
In the decades immediately preceding the Great Migration and the decades immediately following the beginning of the Great Migration into the 1930s, there was a lynching somewhere in the South every 4 days.
Now, one of the people you focus on, you write about Ida Mae Gladney, was a sharecropper in Mississippi along with her husband.
Yes.
What were they up against as sharecroppers?
Sharecroppers essentially worked for free. They worked for the right to stay on the land that they were farming. Their days were long and hard. Cotton is a very difficult thing to grow. The actual person doing the picking had to extract 7,000 bowls or balls of cotton in order to get 100 pounds of cotton, which was considered the standard for picking in that day. If they were day pickers, they might get 75 cents or a dollar for that hard labor that they would have to do. And as it turned out, Ida Mae Gladney was terrible at it. She could never get 100 pounds. Her husband was constantly having to defend her to the planter that they worked for because the planter was complaining that she wasn't, you know, doing her share. She simply wasn't good at it. I never thought about the idea of someone being good or bad at picking cotton. You just figured something that people did. So when the opportunity arose, or actually the circumstances required that they make a decision as to whether they would leave or whether they would stay. In some ways, it was a relief for her because she had not been doing very well at this. And of course, the reason that they left was because a cousin of her husband's had been wrongly accused of stealing something that he had not stolen. The planter and a posse of men abducted him and beat him to within an inch of his life. The thing that he had been accused of stealing turned up the next day, but there were no apologies in order. He was just put in jail. And this woman, Ida Mae Gladney's husband, went to see about his cousin. And when he got back from having seen what had happened to his cousin, he told his wife, "This is the last crop we're making." And they left shortly thereafter for Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. Now, another man you write about, George Starling, had a rebellious streak. He was not happy just working in the fields. And in fact, he spent some time up north in Detroit, worked in a factory, got a taste for higher wages up there, and then came back down to Florida and actually tried to organize other people picking fruit. And this was during World War II, when a lot of men in particular had gone off to fight. And so these southern growers desperately need workers in
absolutely
the field.
Desperately needed what few healthy people they could get to go out and pick. And so that meant to George Starling that this was, they could see how there was this premium on whatever they were picking. It was clearly indicated in the newspaper that the boxes that they were picking were going for $3 or $4 a box, but they were only getting 12 cents or 14 cents, and he began to organize the pickers and say, well, let's try to get a nickel more a box because there's a whole lot more that we're putting ourselves up against and we're not getting paid fairly. The growers absolutely felt that they had to squelch any such activity. That was threatening the very economic system that the growers were dependent upon. It so happened that someone who he had helped forewarned him that he had heard that these people were plotting to lynch him. And when the word got back to George Starling, he decided to leave as soon as he could, and he headed for Harlem.
Now, maybe the biggest surprise to me as I was reading your book was how scared a lot of these people were to leave the South. I mean, literally sneaking off in the middle of the night and not telling anyone or hardly anyone that they were leaving. Why was such secrecy necessary?
The secrecy was necessary because from the very beginning of the Great Migration, there were efforts, massive efforts, to keep it from happening. It began because Northern industry began to recruit African Americans during World War I when European immigration came to a halt and they had all these factories and steel mills and foundries that needed workers. And so they looked to the cheapest labor in the country, which was in the South, and African Americans being the cheapest of them all.
So they were actually sending down recruiters to
try
to bring
down
people up to the northern cities.
Absolutely. What the South did was they began to, they resurrected these laws that had been used during slavery to keep the people from leaving. They first extracted these huge licensing fees from anyone who wanted to recruit. So a northerner who wanted to recruit someone in the South had to pay $25,000 licensing fee in order to recruit African Americans in the South.
But why couldn't some of these African Americans simply just pick up and leave? I mean, you know, slavery had ended decades before.
There could be any number of reasons why the Southern authorities could claim that a black person could not leave. They were citizens of the United States and should have been able to leave of their own free will. And yet, at the train platforms, When the authorities would see that there were large numbers of African Americans seeking to get on a train heading north, they would begin to arrest these African American passengers wholesale. So they went to great lengths in order to keep this cheap labor from leaving. And so Ida Mae Gladney, who we've mentioned earlier before, her family slowly divested of what little they had. They positioned themselves to move for the day or two before their departure to her mother's cabin, and they did not tell anyone that they were leaving. They only told her mother and one cousin of his, of her husband's. And she said to me years later, "You didn't tell people what you were about to do. You just went and did it because people would talk, and then you wouldn't be able to leave."
Hmm. Wow.
And that was in 1937 when she left.
Yeah. And you say that the numbers were astounding. I mean, for instance, in a certain period in Chicago alone, 10,000 people were arriving every month.
So the numbers were staggering, particularly during the war years. You know, it ended up being a total of 6 million, and that's a conservative estimate because it really can't truly be known how many left. What you can see now is that the majority of African Americans that you meet in the North, the Midwest, and the West are, for the most part, descended from people who were part of this great migration. So that is, it's massive to think about the effect that this migration had on the demographics of this country. They were forced into small islands that are now known as ghettos in these cities. Every city in the United States, in the North and the West, had some pocket that where they were limited in terms of where they could live. They were doubled up and tripled up in these cold water flats. And many of them, it was so crowded in some of these northern cities that there were actually workers who rotated the use of a bed. So they were limited into where they could live.
And part of the reason why they were limited was there were all kinds of rules that the white neighborhoods set up to try to prevent black families from
moving. Yes, there were
in.
Restrictive covenants that were put in force in order to keep whites who might have wanted to sell even from doing so, even if they had the inclination to do so. So there was tremendous pushback and hostility and violence even that attended them whenever or greeted them whenever they attempted to break beyond the bounds of the ghettos that they were limited to.
Now, one of the assumptions that a lot of people have made, including a lot of scholars, is that these black people who moved up to the north and into various northern cities were mostly illiterate and uneducated and brought with them what Daniel Patrick Moynihan once called a tangle of pathology. You say this is not remotely the case.
Well, the data do not support that. The data show that these people who participated in this great migration, the 6 million people who came up from the South to all these other points, north and west, they actually were better educated than those that they left behind. They were more likely to be married than the people that they met in the North, meaning the African Americans that they met in the North. And they were more likely to be raising their children in two-parent households than those that they met in the North. They also were more likely, oddly enough, to be making more money than those in the North, not because they were being paid more per hour for their work, but they were working longer hours because they had come from a culture, a caste system, in which they were accustomed to having to work for such long hours for so little pay. And then ultimately, with any immigration experience, it's often judged by what happens to the succeeding generations, too. And the succeeding generations, the picture is mixed. However, one of the great legacies of the Great Migration is that it gave an opportunity for many, many people who are now well-known household names to realize their full potential as Americans in this country. And one great example is Toni Morrison, the Nobel laureate, whose parents migrated from Alabama to Ohio. Their daughter, Toni Morrison, would never have been able to get the chance to read as many books as she later would, because in the South, it was not legal for Black people to go into a library and take out a library book, something as basic as that. How do you become a writer? How do you become a great writer if you don't get a chance to read books? And her parents' migration to Ohio allowed her to be able to go to better schools and to have access to books, which clearly would have had an impact on her ability to become a writer. The same goes for such people as the playwright August Wilson and Lorraine Hansberry and so many other people who have become famous in literature. Ralph Ellison was part of the Great Migration. Richard Wright, the great bard of the Great Migration, had the opportunity or took the opportunity to leave the South. And this is just a small example of the kind of creativity that had the opportunity to flourish because these people's parents decided to migrate.
Isabel Wilkerson is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. Her own parents were some of those who headed north. Wilkerson talked with Steve Paulson. That's it for this hour, but there's more online. If you like To the Best of Our Knowledge, sign up for the podcast. Visit our website, click on the big purple button. It's at ttbook.org. Today's show is produced by Doug Gordon. The rest of the team includes Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Charles Monroe Kane. Music by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Audio wizardry, courtesy of technical director Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Till next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.